Get ready to rumble. Shilling Show Unleashed on the Seven Thunders Media Network. Former city councilor, husband, father, and community watchdog. Your host, Rob Shilling.
Welcome to the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast. Remember, your direct support makes our show possible, and you can directly support this podcast by visiting shillingshow.com and then clicking on the Patreon banner at the top of the page to make a monthly contribution. We appreciate your support.
Shilling Show Unleashed podcast welcomes Jeffrey E. Paul, a research professor in the Social Philosophy Center at West Virginia University. Author of the new book, Winning America's Second Civil War, Progressivism's Authoritarian Threat, Where It Came From, and How to Defeat It. And Jeff Paul, thank you for joining us today on the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast.
Thank you, Rob.
We talk about the Second Civil War. We know what the first one is. What's the second one?
Well, the second one started out of sight, but has had an enormous impact on American political culture. It completely reversed the principles of the American founding into their opposite. That's why it's significant. And the way that it happened, let me describe, first of all, the founding principles of the American Revolution. They were taken from an English author named John Locke, and the founding principles were unprecedented in world history and really haven't been reinstated in any or put in any government since the founding of the United States. And those principles were that nature gave to each member of the human species a property right in themselves, therefore in their liberty, and therefore in the fruits of their labor, their property. Human beings can employ a government to protect those rights, or they can defend them themselves. The government is limited to the protection of those rights and can't pass a law that is in conflict with them. They're pre-legal. They're more fundamental even than the Constitution. The Constitution includes them, but basically there are these pre-legal rights. Should government violate them, then it's an illegitimate government. Those were the original principles. Given that they adopted these principles, the first civil war was inevitable because the first right is the right of self-ownership. The founders knew that all of the subsequent states, the 13 colonies, were all violating that first principle because of slavery. After the revolution was completed, there was consistent tension between the southern states, which had retained slavery, and the northern states, which didn't. And there was a debate that went on from about 1820 to 1861. And the southern states adopted a philosophy of government, which was the antithesis of the founding philosophy. And it could only be resolved by military means, the Civil War. So one would have thought once that war was concluded that these rights would be the solid foundation of the United States into the future. But what happened was that the presidents of America's foremost colleges and universities decided that they wanted to transform their institutions into research institutions. They had only been teaching institutions, pedagogical institutions, up until then. This decision was made in the 1870s, about 5 to 10 years after the close of the Civil War. In order to have research institutions, they had to have doctoral programs, which they did not have. In order to have doctoral programs, they had to hire faculty who had doctorates. The United States didn't award doctorates. Yale had awarded a few, but they really weren't legitimate because the faculty didn't have themselves at Yale didn't have doctorates. So they went to the one European country that had doctoral programs for 200 years, and that was Germany. And they said that they would hire Americans with German doctorates, and that's exactly what they did. They started in around 1875 and continued till the end of the 18th century. It was successful, this move to convert these colleges and universities into research. It was successful with respect to the natural sciences and medicine and engineering and so forth. With respect to the social sciences and the humanities, they imported a political philosophy which was the direct opposite of the founding. And the two philosophies are mutually exclusive. You can either adopt one set of principles or the other set of principles, not both. The principles that were imported from Germany was that the nation is like an organism, and individuals are really like cells of the organism and have only duties to preserve the organism's life. The duties are in particular assigned by the brain of the organism, which consisted of the faculty of German universities, their students in the bureaucracy, and the prince. That view in Germany led to Nazism. In fact, the people who trained the Americans, which came over here, were the same people in Germany who trained the Nazi professoriate and had converted large parts of the university-educated population in Germany to this view that Nazism held once they created this party and then got into power. That view was disguised in the United States from the general public in the following way. They could not call themselves what they would have been called in Germany had they become part of the faculty in Germany, which would have been state socialists. That was the term. It was a good term. It was used in Germany, state socialist. They came over here. Socialism was a bad term. They could never have used it over here. They wouldn't have been hired in the end. They would have gotten fired. A number of faculty that came from Germany did get fired after they made public statements about their views. They had to disguise themselves, and they had to call themselves something other than state socialists. They took a name from the German Progress Party and called themselves progressives. That was the beginning of what we call progressivism today. Since they then educated all Americans who were going for tertiary education, college education, they changed American culture beginning in the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th century. They had a monopoly on the social sciences and the humanities, so they only hired people that they trained and agreed with them, called themselves progressives. And it was one generation after another. In the second generation, included Woodrow Wilson, who got his doctorate at Johns Hopkins. He became president of the United States after being president at Princeton and governor of New Jersey. And he explicitly said in his history that natural rights are a fiction. People have no such rights in his history of the United States. That view continued. After World War I, Germany acquired a bad name in the United States because of its role in World War I, and progressives needed a new name for themselves, and they settled on the name liberalism, and they began to substitute that characterization for themselves for progressivism. That name came into wide use when it was adopted by Roosevelt in the New Deal during the Great Depression. So the people who are called liberal today in the United States have the same genesis as the people who were members of the Nazi Party and leaders of the Nazi Party in Germany. And if you want to know why there is all of this autocratic governance today by the current administration, That's the reason. They believe they're part of an elite. They can do as they please. They can ignore the law. They can ignore the Constitution. They can lie about what they're doing. The preface to the first, to the second Civil War was all these things that transpired in the university. And then you realize that since a large proportion of the population became college educated, it corrupted the media, it corrupted journalism, it corrupted law, it corrupted the general culture. We've come to a point now in the United States where there's a real danger because you've got complete disparity, really, between one party and the other party. This arbitrary governance by one party can culminate in a one-party state. And liberals like Thomas Friedman, who's the columnist for the New York Times, have proposed a one-party state. He did that back in 2008 in the pages of the New York Times. He said the United States should emulate China and just have the Democratic Party. So that's where we are today.
The Shilling Show Unleashed podcast continues in just a moment with our guest, Jeff Paul.
Community-supported investigative journalism. Shilling Show Unleashed.
ShillingShowMedia.com is your one-stop shop for websites, audio and video production, and photography.
ShillingShowMedia.com will take your project from conception to completion.
ShillingShowMedia.com is reasonably priced and highly professional.
Need a website for your business? Visit ShillingShowMedia.com.
Need a video created or edited? Visit ShillingShowMedia.com.
Have a photography or graphic design project? Visit ShillingShowMedia.com.
ShillingShowMedia.com is your one-stop shop for websites, audio and video production, and photography.
Visit ShillingShowMedia.com. That's ShillingShowMedia.com.
Looking out for us. Rob Schraub.
The Shilling Show Unleashed podcast. We continue now. The book is Winning America's Second Civil War. Our guest is the author, Jeffrey E. Paul. So in order to have a war, you need to have people that are willing to fight. And it seems like the left, the totalitarians, the authoritarians are doing everything they can to intimidate people who are right-minded and constitutionally minded into cowering and to be fearful that they may be persecuted or even jailed for expressing themselves. So how do you have a civil war in a civilization where people are not necessarily willing to fight?
You can't have a successful war for those who are still adhere to the founding principles if there's no one willing to defend them. However, if there are people willing to defend them, I have some strategies and somebody's got to be willing to employ them. In the first place, I would say that the immediate danger has to be averted in the next election, because if it's not averted in the next election, given what this administration has been willing to do, the laws that it's regularly violated, the lawfare that it's used to prevent the competing candidate from having a chance to win, the attempt to put him in prison and so forth, this election is very crucial. My advice to Trump, one of the pieces of advice I would give him is to propose a dramatic tax cut, which would contrast directly with what Biden is planning to do, which is make a major tax increase. I think that would give him a significant advantage if he keeps repeating that this is what he favors, because it's something that would affect everyone and principally the middle class. Then after that, if he should win the election, I have a proposal in the book for a new tax regime, which I think would be enormously popular. I had three economists work on this for me. And what we found is that if you had a little above a 1% universal sales tax — we've never had a universal sales tax, that would not be a retail sales tax, it would be a tax on all sales of anything. So, for example, the sales of stocks bonds, derivatives, all of those would have a 1%, slightly more than 1% tax. And what we found working back over 10 years from 2021 back to 2011 is that in every one of those years, that tax would raise more money than the present system. So that tax would replace the whole present system. Personal income tax, personal payroll tax, corporate income tax, corporate payroll tax, estate tax, gift tax, capital gains tax. It would replace all of that. And it would allow the average person, the middle class person, and the lower class people to have more money to expend than they have today. I think that would be enormously attractive to a majority of voters, including many Democrats, many people who would typically vote Democrat. And so those would be my two suggestions for gaining an immediate majority that might last for some time for the Republican Party. Should it get into power for any length of time, it needs to do the following things. It needs to stop making all grants of any kind to universities, whether they're state or private universities. No federal money should be going to them because they're all sectarian churches. And the doctrine they communicate is basically the same as that which was the founding of, provides the foundation for National Socialism. That has to be expunged from the education system. More aggressively, at the state level, governors need to do what was done in Florida with the state education system and what has been done here in Ohio with the state education system, where universities are required to add a Department of Civic Education, where there is the founding views are represented. They're virtually never represented in the political science departments, the philosophy departments, the history departments particularly, and even the economics departments. There's a rather considerable divide in economics. We had generation after generation which has produced very bad outcomes. You wonder why in television, the media, except for Fox News and Newsmax and a couple of other outfits, are uniformly why Ronald McDaniels was fired after 1 week because their people protested. They're basically sectarian churches is what they are, and secular churches is what I should say. And so that's what the universities have become with respect to the social sciences and philosophies. They're there to indoctrinate the students. I have a whole chapter with surveys of faculty political opinion in it, and it's astounding if you look at it. I know because I've been teaching since 1974 at many different institutions. You have virtually no people at most universities who hold my views. There are a few, there are a smattering of us, but it's extremely unusual. You know, when you think back and now you've had seven or eight generations with this kind of education, you're slowly corrupting the political culture. Undermine the political culture that had become the foundation for the American Revolution and the creation of the United States.
Looking at those, and they're all excellent recommendations, the Republicans, if elected, are going to have to act quickly, and they have been reticent to do that in the past when they have held the reins of power to act quickly and decisively. So do you have hope ultimately for the future of America based on past performance of the Republican Party and their timidity?
I am cautiously optimistic because of Trump. And the reason I say that is not because I regard him as the equal of someone like Ronald Reagan, who had deep philosophical convictions, who had read a lot, and whose philosophical convictions had been publicly announced for a couple of decades before he became president. Trump is not like that. He sort of goes by instinct. But the thing that is unusual about him is he's a warrior. He can't be intimidated. That's what the Democrats saw in him, why they became alarmed, even though, unlike Reagan, he'd not spelled out some political philosophy, which would have been a replication of the founders' philosophy. Reagan had done that, but he hadn't done it. Goldwater did it, but Trump hadn't done that. On the other hand, Trump can't be intimidated. He's a warrior. And that's what you need in these circumstances. He won't be intimidated, and he will restore as much as he can. He only has 4 years to do it. Hopefully, he would be then succeeded by someone with very strong convictions, Ron DeSantis or one of the other people who have very strong convictions. Hopefully, that person would get elected because of the things that Trump is able to accomplish, including a reduction in taxes. I mean, if you recall Ronald Reagan, that really made him popular in the United States, the reduction in taxes and the economic outcome as a result. I mean, the economy thrived under Reagan as a result of those tax cuts. That's what I rest my hope on. On the other hand, I have to say that I think this is the most important election in American history. I think the country's future hangs on it. And I think the Democrats are fully aware that they're in a battle. And in my opinion, they're in a battle to become a one-party state. They're not going to tolerate a significant alternative to their view, which is the opposite of the founders' view. It's interesting because the first person who really recognized what was happening in the United States was himself a progressive. He'd started off as a progressive, and he became the most famous journalist in the United States. He wrote columns, opinion columns, and that was a man named Walter Lippmann, and he was known all over. In the middle of the New Deal, he wrote a book called The Good Society, in which he denounced the New Deal as fascist and Roosevelt as fascist. And his fellow progressives were stunned and shocked at this book. And it was the first person whose eyes had opened and understood what had happened in the United States and what was happening during the New Deal. All of the aspects of the New Deal, the National Industrial Recovery Act, Roosevelt's refusal to pass an anti-lynching law because the South was suffering from the Ku Klux Klan, the rounding up of all peoples of Japanese citizenry, not fulfilling the quotas for Jews who wanted to immigrate to the United States. Roosevelt only would fill about 20% of those quotas. It was a radically different regime from any that preceded it, but he was an extremely attractive speaker, and we'd come through a Great Depression that had occurred under the governance of, a Republican president. That's when people began to see what was happening. A number of people after that began to see, and they realized that it came out of the universities. William F. Buckley wrote a book called God, Man at Yale, in which he described his experience as an undergraduate at Yale in 1950. And then starting in the 1950s, they started doing surveys of faculty political opinion. And people were astounded because they were exactly the reverse of the American people. And they've only gotten worse since. I mean, you may have noticed a couple of years ago, the Harvard Crimson does a political survey of the faculty every year, the Harvard Crimson being a student newspaper at Harvard. And in 2022, 80% of the faculty said they were liberal or very liberal. Now, that included the engineering faculty, the chemistry faculty, the business faculty, et cetera. If you look then at just the social science and the history department, political science, and so on, it's much higher. You know, it's usually, typically in those departments, it's about 95% are liberal, very liberal, or far left. And you might have one or two people here or there that dissent from that. It's been like that for a long time because of the monopoly that the faculty originally acquired in hiring faculty members in the 1880s. They hadn't had that before. Presidents appointed faculties, but that the hiring of faculties, the appointment of faculty members was given to the present faculty members, and that's the way it's been ever since. There's just been this monopoly, this ideological monopoly, and you can see the outcome all around you.
Jeffrey E. Paul has written Winning America's Second Civil War. Jeff, if we want to get a copy of the book, follow your work online, is there a place we can do that?
You can get the book at Amazon. You can get the book at, now this is online I'm talking about, you can get the book almost anywhere online.
You've done a tremendous job in laying out the case and giving us hope for the future. Jeff Paul, thanks for joining us today on the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast.
Thank you so much, Rob. I appreciate it.
That concludes another edition of the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast. Visit us online at shillingshow.com, where you can directly support this podcast by clicking on the Patreon banner at the top of the page and making a monthly donation. Your support is essential for the continuation of the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast. Until next time.